Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. Today, we open with the results of our own East County Magazine special report on COVID-19 cases in East County schools. Find out on today's show which district has the most cases that we know of, and which districts fail the transparency test for not informing the public about coronavirus cases in their schools. Next on our Capitol Report, learn where former Congressman Duncan D. Hunter will be serving his prison sentence and what he might expect during his time behind bars after pleading guilty to a federal corruption charge. Our newsmaker interview today is with Vicki Knight Butcher. She's a candidate running for the Helix Water District Board of Directors, challenging incumbent Joel Scalziti. Vicki brings a reservoir of water knowledge to the race, having formerly served on the state's Water Quality Control Board and as executive director of Water for Children Africa, a charity that has helped bring safe drinking water to families in countries across the world. On the second half of our show today, we'll have some national news stories from Public News Service, including highlights of the final presidential debate, information on IRS tax refunds, and why COVID-19 relief legislation remains stalled in Congress. Then we'll have audio from the county's first ever virtual groundbreaking ceremony at the new Equestrian Center in Lakeside. From California News Service, hear warnings on dire impacts California could face if the Supreme Court overturns the Affordable Care Act. Plus, get details about three criminal justice reform initiatives on your November ballot. And finally, we'll be replaying our interview with Molly Moon, the author of Five Wishes, a novel about an immigrant's journey to America that remains as relevant today as it was when we first spoke with her several years ago. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
How safe is it to send your child back to school amid a pandemic, or for teachers to provide instruction inside classrooms? An East County Magazine investigation checked out the websites of all school districts in San Diego's East County to find out how many cases have been reported at schools that have reopened, and how transparent each district is in making this information available to parents, teachers, and staff. As of Thursday, the County Public Health Department has not reported any outbreaks of three or more cases at any East County school. But some school districts do have cases among students, staff, or both. It's unclear whether these cases were contracted on campus or elsewhere. Cajon Valley Union School District was the first in East County to reopen and was praised in a New York Times article for its pioneering efforts to bring children back into the classroom in a district that has many working parents and immigrant families who face challenges teaching children at home. Despite many safety precautions, however, the district now has the most cases and highest rate of COVID-19 of any East County primary or high school district. As of Thursday, 15 students have tested positive, along with three staff members. The overall rate is still low at 1.4 cases per every 1,000 students. Cajon Valley has set up a special webpage where it is reporting case numbers and rates daily, but the district does not disclose on its website which of its 38 schools have cases. The two most transparent districts are Santee School District and Lakeside Union School District. Both have web pages that list total cases, case rates, and a breakdown by school. Santee reports just two cases, one each at Carlton Oaks and Pepper Drive schools. Lakeside reports one student with COVID-19 at Tierra del Sol Middle School and no cases among employees. Alpine Union School District does not yet have a page tracking COVID cases, but a letter from the superintendent posted on the district's website discloses that Alpine has had one coronavirus case in a student at Boulder Oaks Elementary School. Other districts lack transparency, so we don't know if they've had any cases or which schools may be affected. districts that reopened for at least some in-person learning, but which have no information for tracking COVID cases on their websites are Borrego Springs Unified School District, Dehesa School District, Grossmont Union High School District, Grossmont Cuyamaca Community College District, Julian Union School District, Julian High School District, and Mountain Empire Unified School District. Several districts have not yet reopened, but plan to do so in late October or November. These include La Mesa Spring Valley, Jamul del Zura, Ramona Unified, and Warner Springs Unified School Districts. It remains to be seen whether these districts will set up pages for parents, teachers, and staff to get information if any COVID-19 cases occur at their schools. The Lemon Grove School District has not yet announced a reopening date for in-person learning, according to its website. The worst record of COVID-19 cases by far among San Diego County schools is held by San Diego State University, which shut down in-person learning immediately after a major outbreak occurred right after classes resumed in August. The case numbers are disclosed on the college's website. Since August, SDSU has reported a whopping 1,199 cases, including 16 faculty and staff members, 13 visitors, 419 students living on campus, and 780 students living off campus. The outbreak was fueled largely by college students who reportedly attended parties and failed to abide by masking and social distancing requirements. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine's Capitol Report. Disgraced former Congressman Duncan D. Hunter will begin serving his 11-month prison sentence on January 4th. His defense lawyer told Roll Call that Hunter will be sent to a minimum security camp at the Federal Correctional Institute La Tuna in El Paso County, Texas. Famous past inmates at La Tuna have included George Jung, a member of the Medellin drug cartel, whose life story was featured in the Johnny Depp film Blow. Hunter, a former Marine Corps combat veteran, resigned from Congress last January after pleading guilty to spending campaign donations on a lavish personal lifestyle. He and his wife were accused of diverting $250,000 in donor funds. Margaret Hunter also pled guilty, and she was sentenced to 8 months of home confinement after cooperating with prosecutors. According to the prosecution, Hunter's lavish expenditures included overnight trips with mistresses, family vacations to Europe and Hawaii, jewelry, and tuition at his children's private school. Although he initially claimed he was innocent, he eventually pleaded guilty, stating that he did so to avoid putting his family through the ordeal of a trial. At La Tuna, Hunter can expect to be assigned a prison job, wake up at 6 a.m. every morning, and he must remain alcohol and drug-free. That's quite a lifestyle change for Hunter, who was once named the biggest party animal in Congress by Washingtonian Magazine. His decision to postpone resigning until January ran out the clock for a special election and resulted in the seat being left vacant for nearly a year by the time a new congressman is seated in January. Amar Campanajar and Daryl Issa, the winners in the Democratic and Republican primary elections last March, are now in the November 3rd runoff election, vying to be the next representative in the 50th Congressional District, which encompasses most of East County as well as other parts of San Diego. According to three recent polls, the two are running neck and neck in a virtual dead heat that may come down to turnout and coattails in the presidential race. Duncan D. Hunter is not the first San Diego congressman to do time in federal prison. Former Republican Congressman Randy Duke Cunningham, an ex-military hero, was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison after he pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit bribery and tax evasion. He was released after 7 years. A San Diego Union-Tribune investigation found that Cunningham, like Hunter, used his position to fund a lavish lifestyle, including a mansion, yachts, and hunting trips with ill-gotten gain. Cunningham once praised former Congressman Duncan Hunter, father of the disgraced Congressman Duncan D. Hunter, as his mentor. Perhaps Hunter may follow in the footsteps of Cunningham, who authored several books while in prison and told reporters after his release that he planned to write another book on prison reforms based on his experiences behind bars and not the kind of bars frequented by Hunter during his freewheeling time in Washington, D.C.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine, and I am delighted today to welcome our special guest, Vicki Butcher. Vicki is one of four candidates running for the Helix Water Board in the Division 5 seat, which I understand includes portions of El Cajon, Granite Hills, Bostonia, and Lakeside. The incumbent is Director Joel Scalziti. He's one of the candidates. The other two are Lou Tejeda, who's a former employee of the district, and Tyler Logan. Neither of those two submitted a ballot statement, and we couldn't find a campaign website for either of them. So it looks like the race has two serious contenders, Director Scalziti and Vicki Butcher, who says she wants to bring her reservoir of water knowledge to the seat. So Vicki, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Miriam.
So tell us why you're running for the Helix Water District Board.
Miriam, I have had water as my passion for a number of years. I have worked with a very special nonprofit to take safe, sustainable water to villages on the continent of Africa. And in addition to that, I have served my own community and served on various boards, commissions, and I'm committed to making my community a better place to live.
Very good. Let's talk a little bit more about that water-relevant experience. I understand that, among other things, you were appointed by a governor to serve on the California Water Quality Control Board, as well as being executive director of Water for Children Africa. So tell us some of the things that you learned or how those experiences will benefit the people of the Helix Water District if you're elected.
The experience of serving on the state Water Quality Control Board was extremely important because I had the opportunity to have a firsthand view of how we in our own community get water from the way that it enters into the state, how it travels, how gravity is used to bring water to drier regions such as East County, San Diego. I literally went on a trip and followed the water from the Colorado River all the way down to our county. Extremely informational and educational. Another issue that we dealt with on the State Water Board was the desalinization plant that was built in North County. And the issues that arose at that time, of course, dealt with the cost, of course, and also dealt with what would happen to the environment and the small fish and how we could alleviate such harsh impacts. So I did learn an awful lot serving on the State Water Quality Control Board.
Yeah, and I understand that through your work on Water for Children Africa, you know, organization that you founded or you and your mother founded, that you have actually traveled to countries all over the world. And then you come back, and I understand you hold educational seminars about water issues. Is that correct?
That is correct, Miriam. And we have been doing this for over 25 years. And we have actually had the experience of partnering with small villages and schools to either drop boreholes, or as we call them, wells, or to provide water catchment tanks, and in some instances to help the villages repair existing water supply systems. So it has been a learning curve, and I have been deeply appreciative of the many trips that I have made and the partnerships that we have formed.
Very good. Tell us a little bit about some of the other experiences in government that you've had or leadership roles. And I have to say, this is one of the most impressive bios I think I've ever seen. The list is too long to read for one show. But give us a few of the highlights, Vicki.
Well, I have served on many boards and commissions. And I've served at the city level, the county level, the state, as we mentioned, and the international level. I was a planning commissioner for 12 years for the El Cajon Planning Commission. Mm-hmm. And also I worked at the County Board of Supervisors for the chair of the board and dealt with such issues as cetanol-free nuclear waste. I have served on the major YMCA board and several school boards, PTA boards, and have been doing so over the years. We have raised 5 children in the district.
With your late husband, Dr. Butcher, who many people, I'm sure, remember fondly, but we should add he was the president of the National Medical Association, and you headed up the auxiliary doing some medical programs to help people, right?
Absolutely, we did. We did cancer program, cancer prevention, cancer mm-hmm. education programs throughout the country, throughout the nation. And Dr. Butcher was team physician at Granite Hills High School for over 46 years. And he did the physicals and went to the football games and scooped up the players and helped to mend them once they went down. But it has been a wonderful experience. And I would like to give a shout out to a really special person. My brother Oscar Knight was the international trustee for the National Kiwanis Clubs prior to his passing. So he did a lot of service in our community as well and really helped out an awful lot during the Cedar Fires.
Yes, and I know you've been involved in all kinds of service clubs and Rotary International and on the
Yes.
City or County's Human Relations Commission. So I think you'll get the idea. Lots and lots and lots of good works and giving back to the community in many different ways. Vicki, let me ask you this on a more serious note. Two of your opponents, actually, this is really unusual. I've never had a race before where two of the people running have previously been elected and actually stepped down after their residency was challenged. Mr. Tejeda had a residency challenge. He resigned immediately after, elected in November, stepped down in January. He said it wasn't because of that it was because of he suddenly had taken a job that was a conflict of interest. Mr. Scalziti, the incumbent, actually was previously elected and forced to step down when his opponent filed suit or filed a complaint. And a judge actually ordered him to step down, found that, yes, he really was not living in the district at the time. He since has moved back into the district. That was a long time ago and was reelected and has been serving on the board, you know, ever since. But it does beg the question of, Vicki, how long have you lived in the district?
Miriam, we have lived in this very home for over 38 years. Mm-hmm. Our 5 children have been raised in our home here, and some of whom have graduated from Granite Hills and returned to serve Granite Hills along with their father. So we are long-term residents, long-term committed to our community, and it is a pleasure to be a part, a long-term resident of East County.
Very good. Water rates, of course, are always the hottest issue in any water board race, I think. This board used to hold hearings annually, every year, where the public could come in and, you know, say their piece about water rates. And a few years ago, they decided to switch to doing this only every 5 years. So what are your views on rate hikes in general? People always, you know, want to know when, if ever, you think a rate hike would be appropriate. And also, do you think that the public should be able to speak out on these with annual hearings on any proposed rate? I should say not just rate hike, but rate changes either way.
Miriam, I am for responsible considerations, discussions, and transparency. I think that the public has a right to hear how the board discusses the issue of rate hikes because it impacts families so greatly. Mm-hmm. And in the context of the 5-year, 1-year dichotomy, I think we have to deal with the now. And for now, we are dealing with COVID-19, and we are dealing with an extraordinary time in our history where families are all challenged. And I believe that we must consider rate hikes at this time and also allow the constituents and people to deal with their own reality. Life is changing. COVID-19 has made that so.
So when you say consider rate hikes, do you mean that you would try to hold rate hikes down, or you think they should be raised, or?
I think that I would do everything possible to keep rate hikes down. I have been a board member long enough to understand that my vote is one vote, one voice, but right. I would certainly listen to the people and hear what their concerns were and be a representative voice. I would not bring my preconceived concerns and speak out as Vicki Knight Butcher. I would speak out as a representative of those who are in charge of making these rate hikes happen and are they affordable for the constituents?
Right. If a rate hike is needed at all. And of course, that's there are outside factors such as whether you know, the water authority, whether the rates to the district get increased, you know, or not. Good point. So another question on water rates. The Helix Water District, last time I checked, assesses water rates on a per property basis. Some other districts look at other factors. A person who has a larger lot or a larger family in Helix would be pushed into the highest tier, no matter how much you try to conserve, no matter how many water conservation devices you put in. Whereas in Padre, for example, they look at family size and lot size, and they make some allowances for that. Do you think that's something that Helix should consider doing?
I definitely think it's something that Helix should consider doing, simply because we as human beings take things seriously or not so seriously. And it isn't fair to those who are actively engaged in conservation, trying to cut down on the water usage, to be charged the same thing regardless. And I would certainly be, I would fall on the side of saying, please, let us consider family size, let us consider lot size, but let us consider water usage as well.
Okay, very good. Director Scalzitti led efforts a few years ago that saved the campground at Lake Jennings from closing down. I think that's something that almost everybody thought was a good thing. He actually organized a committee that put it back into profitability when the board was on the verge of voting to close it down forever. So my question to you is, would you commit to keep this community resource open at Lake Jennings?
I believe that that is an excellent resource for the community, and I would very much commit to keeping it open and seeing how could we improve it.
Very good. With climate change, water has become an increasingly scarce resource in many places, certainly including Southern California and San Diego's East County. Helix has taken some steps, such as a program, a regional program to purify and recycle water, also increasing water storage facilities. I would like to ask if you support those efforts, and do you have any other creative ideas for increasing our local water supply, increasing or preserving our local water supply, improving water quality, or whatever else you'd like to talk about?
I would like to see us look a little more closely at gray water. How can we better use the water that we already have? Mm-hmm. We are a community that is being more and more sensitized to plants and using landscaping that is more appropriate to our community. And I think that we should focus and educate and continue to educate. Gray water, appropriate plants, and there are steps that we as a community can and should be sensitized to and be willing to go forward and do.
Okay. You've mentioned transparency is important to you. Director Scalzitti was on a committee at the Water District a few years ago, which came up with a proposal that sought to require a board member who spoke to the media to have to let the rest of the board know about this. And if they didn't, there would have been penalties imposed, which could have included removing them from committees or forfeiting their per diem payments and expense reimbursements. I would like to know what you think about restrictions like that. And do you think a director should be free to talk to the public or the press or whoever they want to without having to worry about that?
I definitely believe that First Amendment rights should be extended to board of directors as well as individual citizens. We are free to be, to think, and to say. And if there are concerns, then they should be aired publicly, openly, and transparently, because we have the right to be available to our own commitments, to our own way of approaching problem solving. So I do not think that it should be penalized.
Okay. One move that this board took recently was they moved the meetings from 2:00 in the afternoon to the evenings so that more working people would be able to attend them. That was before COVID, and now we're in the era of Zoom. So my question to you is, do you support keeping the meetings at night or the early evening? And once the COVID-19 restrictions on gatherings end, do you think they ought to keep live streaming or putting, you know, videos up on the website or anything so that more people can see what's going on?
Miriam, I think that we can and should appreciate the value of some of the fallout of this incredibly difficult time. And I do believe that virtual meetings and evening meetings are a positive thing. It allows working people to participate, to hear, and to be a part of the issues and how they are discussed and how they are resolved by various board members. It is a part of transparency. And with the technology that we now have and the practice, prior to COVID-19, we didn't Zoom at all. And now Zoom is the norm. It's the new normal. And I believe that it is a positive, and I believe I support it greatly for encouraging community citizens to see and to be a part of board meetings.
Very good. And, you know, we've learned with Zoom, it's so easy to hit record, and then you've got both a video and an audio recording of it. Do you think they should keep those for a while? You know, some districts destroy them right after the meetings, and some of them keep them up for a couple of years, but what do you think?
I think that keeping them up and allowing people to see them at their convenience and not try to fit every round peg into a square hole. Yeah. We don't all have the same time commitments. We have children, we have bedtimes, we have dinner time. And if we can just leave these recordings up, it's not a problem to do so because of the technology available and let people participate.
Yeah, exactly. It costs like a few bucks a month to buy extra cloud storage so you can keep a year's worth of these things up there. So, what else would you like the public to know, Vicki, about you and your candidacy? And I'll leave that kind of open-ended. If there's ideas we didn't talk about or endorsements or how they can get in touch with you, what else do you want them to know?
Well, I would like for them to know that my board experience is extensive and that one of the highlights of training teams to participate, to go to Africa and to support villages was to take a team down to Imperial Valley and to see the Imperial Water District and how they conduct their use of agricultural water. Hmm. The learning curve has been incredible to see that they actually have an address for each patch of a field. Yes, and if the plants need more water, they can push a button and water that section of the field. The learning and the exposure and participating on various boards and commissions, I believe, have given me an extraordinary opportunity and ability to learn and be an effective board member. And I really would like to ask the voters to entrust this seat as a member of the Board of Directors on Helix Water District.
Where else can people get more information about you and your candidacy, Vicki?
We have a website up, and you can just Google Vicki Knight Butcher, and hopefully they will find me and my statements.
And for those listening on radio, on KNSJ, that's spelled V-I-C-K-I-E, Knight is K-N-I-G-H-T, Butcher, B-U-T-C-H-E-R. Or you can go on our site at eastcountymagazine.org, go into our politics section there, and we'll have a copy of this video up, as well as links to learn more about Vicki and all of the candidates running for
them on the ballot. And I do have a ballot statement, and it is very succinct because the experience that I have shared with you is written in the ballot statement, as they can read it there.
Very good. Well, Vicki, thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso and video that'll be broadcast on our website at eastcountymagazine.org.
Thank you so much for having me. I really do appreciate the opportunity to let the voters know that I am a qualified candidate and I am willing to serve on the Board of Directors. Thank you, Miriam. I appreciate it.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast. I'm Mary Sherman. The second and final debate of the 2020 election is in the books. with President Donald Trump's handling of the pandemic first on the list of topics.
We're rounding the turn. We're rounding the corner. It's going away.
Learning to live with it. Come on. We're dying with it.
Trump continually portrayed his Democratic challenger as a typical politician, while Joe Biden argued that Trump was an incompetent leader. On immigration, the former vice president confronted President Trump on the more than 500 children separated from their parents at the southern border.
They got separated from their parents, and it makes us a laughingstock and violates every notion of who we are as a nation.
Let me ask you a follow-up question.
Kristen, they did it. We changed the policy.
Your response
they
to that?
They did it. We changed.
Did not.
They built the cages. Who built the cages,
let's,
Joe?
Let's talk about what
who
we're
built
talking
the cages,
about.
Joe?
Let's talk about what we're talking about. What happened? Parents were ripped. Their kids were ripped from their arms and separated.
When asked about race in America, Biden said Trump is the most racist president in history.
We've all constantly been moving the needle further and further to inclusion, not exclusion. This is the first president to come along and says that's the end of that.
Trump countered that he's done more for black people than any president since Abraham Lincoln.
As far as all people, I think I have great relationships with all people. I am the least racist person in this room.
With less than 2 weeks to go until the election, Biden currently has a larger lead in national polls than Hillary Clinton did at this point in 2016. The U.S. is now reporting nearly 60,000 new COVID-19 cases each day, a roughly 70% increase since mid-September. The number of Americans hospitalized has increased by at least 40%. According to data from Johns Hopkins University, 31 states are reporting at least 10% more new COVID-19 cases this week compared to last week. And as Mike Moen reports, a leading epidemiologist in Minnesota warns the region and the nation could be in for a rough winter.
The state health department says Minnesota is averaging more than 1,000 cases each day this month. There's also concern about a recent spike in coronavirus fatalities. Michael Osterholm, who directs the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, says based on a variety of trends, the public should brace for more troubling reports.
I think we are about to enter the darkest days of the pandemic, not only here in Minnesota, but throughout the entire country. A combination of pandemic fatigue, pandemic anger, and then just the increased frequency of indoor air exposures.
He says families might still be planning holiday gatherings despite the risk of spreading the virus. Osterholm also notes some hospitals might not have enough specialized staff to treat patients in intensive care units, and he worries the production of PPE won't be enough to meet the rising demand.
This is PNS. The FDA said it's formally approved remdesivir as the first drug to treat COVID-19. The approval indicates the drug has cleared more rigorous regulatory hurdles involving a more thorough review of clinical data and manufacturing quality since it was given emergency authorization in May. As Washington lawmakers consider how to recover from the economic effects of the pandemic, a new report from the Economic Opportunity Institute recommends changing the state tax structure to make it more progressive instead of reducing public services.
During the last recession, lawmakers opted to make cuts to health care, including mental health services, as well as child care and federal assistance programs. They also increased K-12 class sizes and hiked college tuition. John Burbank, EOI's executive director, says even before the pandemic, Washington hadn't yet returned to its pre-2008 levels of funding and services.
Even though we've had tremendous increase of wealth and income in our state, particularly at the very top, the state has failed to keep up with that in terms of the provision of services.
The report says low and moderate income households in Washington pay much more in state and local taxes than in other states, and wealthy households pay less. And the pandemic job losses have had an outsized impact on low and moderate wage workers in fields like food service, healthcare, and local government, as well as people of color. I'm Lily Bolke.
The IRS is still delivering the remaining federal stimulus payments from the initial round and coordinating with local and regional agencies to identify people who may not know they qualified in the first place. An estimated 9 million people who normally don't file taxes can still claim their check by November 21st. Coordinator of the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program at United Way of Greater Nashville, Tamara Cray, cites many reasons people don't file.
They just didn't have the income, or perhaps they're in that in-between area because of their age. They're just coming out of school and didn't work enough hours or enough to earn enough money to have a filing requirement.
It remains unclear whether Congress will pass another coronavirus relief package that includes a second round of stimulus payments. Disaster food benefits are available for Oregon residents in 8 counties affected by September's massive wildfires.
Dan Hahn is director of self-sufficiency programs at the Oregon Department of Human Services. He says the Disaster Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or DSNAP, is meant to reach people in need who typically aren't eligible for food assistance.
It's just an opportunity to take some of that anxiety that exists with all of the losses that individuals and families have had and allow them to have a little something extra to bridge that gap as they get back to normal.
Disaster SNAP will provide a month of benefits. The last day to apply is Wednesday. I'm Eric Tegedoff.
I'm Mary Sherman for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
This week, the County of San Diego held its first ever virtual groundbreaking at the new Lakeside Equestrian Center. And here's what that sounded like. Supervisor Diane Jacob, long a supporter of the equestrian community across East County, had this to say at the groundbreaking.
It's a very exciting day for Lakeside, and there is no better place in the entire county of San Diego for a first-of-a-kind, state-of-the-art equestrian facility. What's unique about it is there's going to be a 45,000-square-foot covered arena. There's going to be a large community center and other amenities for the community. We're going to have people come in here to this facility all over the county and even outside the county because there's nothing like it.
Lessick Formuler from the County Parks and Recreation Department provided more details.
We've taken a close look at other facilities that are considered best practice facilities around the country and how they operate. And we're going to incorporate some of those things into the program plan for this facility as well.
The facility, it's a little over 13 acres. Construction is anticipated to start November, December and last about 13 months. We should be opening the facility in early 2022.
The facility is a welcome new addition to Lakeside for many of its residents, including Timothy Armstrong.
For the youth of the community, I think it's something good. You know, it's hard to get kids into outside activities, you know, whether that be sports, soccer events type things. Equine is a big event here in the Lakeside community. A facility like this that the county is going to be able to run and manage and organize is going to be fulfilling for a lot of the youth members that don't have that property for them to do that at.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
Almost 4 million Californians gained health coverage when the Affordable Care Act expanded Medi-Cal, and that goes away if the Supreme Court strikes down the law without a replacement. That's just one jaw-dropping warning at a hearing held Wednesday by the State Senate Committee on Health. Health policy consultant Deborah Reedy Kelch said the Golden State would pay dearly if the court kills the ACA.
The UC Berkeley Labor Center estimates that California could annually lose $27 billion and potentially 299,000 jobs if the ACA was struck down.
President Donald Trump says he will protect people with pre-existing conditions, but his Justice Department is arguing that the entire law must go now that Congress has repealed the individual mandate. Melanie Fontes-Rayner with the State Attorney General's office says in any case, the rest of the law should remain in force even without a mandate that everyone buy coverage or pay a fine.
This president, in his own words, wants to explode the ACA. We don't think that health care should just be for those who are healthy or rich. And we've done everything in our power to fight his sabotage of the Affordable Care Act.
Without the ACA, insurance companies could once again kick young adults 18 to 26 off their parents' health plans. They could reimpose annual and lifetime spending limits on coverage and would no longer be required to cover mental health or addiction services. Before the ACA, people with pre-existing conditions such as heart disease, diabetes, or even pregnancy could be denied coverage or charged sky-high premiums. State Senator Dr. Richard Pan says COVID would likely be considered a pre-existing condition going forward.
The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services said 19 to 50% had a
pre-existing condition when it came to healthcare coverage. When we talk about overturning the ACA, we're talking about something that could affect half of all Americans.
Trump Supreme Court nominee Judge Amy Coney Barrett, who has been critical of the ACA, is expected to be confirmed before opening arguments begin on November 10th. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. In 2 weeks, Californians will decide on 3 criminal justice reform ballot measures. Proposition 25 would repeal the current system of cash bail. Instead, people would be released while awaiting trial for certain low-level crimes. For mid-level crimes, a judge would use an algorithm to help decide whether a person must be held until trial. Those accused of serious crimes would remain behind bars until trial. Mike Harold with the Western Center on Law and Poverty says cash bail is very punitive for low-income defendants.
Many people ended up getting held in jail for months on end simply because they didn't have the money to be able to get out on bail. And then other folks who did get out on bail often were stuck with very large bills.
Right now, even if the charges are dropped, you still have to pay 10% back to the bail bondsman. Opponents say the change will put the entire bail bond industry out of business. Proposition 17 would allow certain felons to regain their right to vote once they have finished their sentence, whereas right now they remain disenfranchised, often for many years, until both their sentence and their parole is complete. Proposition 20 would restrict or deny early parole for certain violent crimes. It would reclassify certain crimes as so-called wobblers, likely resulting in higher penalties, and require DNA collection for some misdemeanors. Harold says Prop 20 would have a disproportionate effect on people of color.
We're over-policing, and too many people are being drawn into the criminal justice system for minor things that end up sticking with them for the rest of their lives.
Prop 20 would roll back reforms passed by voters via Propositions 47 and 57. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
And next up, we have one of our Best of East County segments, recorded back in 2015, but still relevant today, our interview with Molly Moon, the author of the novel Five Wishes on an Immigrant's Journey.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Molly Moon, author of the new novel, Five Wishes. My guest is also a German immigrant who empathizes with the plight of immigrants and refugees in our current political climate. Her novel takes us on just this kind of heart-rending journey from the shanty towns of Honduras to the anonymity of L.A. Five Wishes is her second novel. Welcome, Molly. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor.
Let's start with your own experiences as an immigrant. Tell me your story. What was immigrating like for you, and how does it inspire your writing?
I first came to San Diego to attend San Diego State University when I had a Fulbright scholarship, and I studied Spanish as my major, in Germany I studied English and Spanish to become a translator, so Spanish was my main objective at San Diego State. And then when I graduated, I looked for a job, but I didn't have a lot of experience. And yet I was completely enthusiastic, thinking, everybody's waiting for me.
Of course.
I'm this great new person. You know, I graduated. And then I realized that people weren't waiting for me. And I had no resources. I had no family in the country. I had a friend that I stayed with. But my friend was also out of work, so we both had no resources. And so I ended up finding a job at a bakery in Irvine. So I moved from San Diego to Irvine, and that was my first job in California. And I rented a room, one room in a house, because I had no other money. Mm-hmm. I had no transportation, so that family gave me a bike that their children had used. It had no gears. And so I trekked 5 miles up the road to the bakery and 5 miles back home every day. And after a couple of months of doing that, I thought, you know, I have a college degree and I'm selling bakery goods, and that's not really what I came for. So I started looking for other opportunities. And then my next job, I actually found in a medical office. So I worked with a medical doctor, and I finally got more into the environment I wanted to be in, kind of more toward the corporate world. And unfortunately, after about 7 or 8 months in that job, that medical doctor made sexual advances. Oh. And when I declined, I suddenly had no job the next day. He didn't say he fired me, but he suddenly had no more money to pay for my position.
That must have been very isolating, getting into this kind of situation in a foreign country.
It was very frightening. Luckily, I had made friends with some people around me, and mm-hmm. there was a job opening in a law firm, so I became a legal secretary. And that became my career path, basically. I started as a legal secretary and then moved from there into the corporate world. And, you know, and so I still actually work in the corporate world now, financing my writing until it takes mm-hmm. off completely.
Well, you know, here, living so close to Tijuana, we're really acquainted with the constant border crossings and the border checks and the crimes of drug and human trafficking. Tell us a little bit about your protagonist. I know she's very different than you. She comes from very humble beginnings. And her flight across the border, how did your experience sort of segue into that story?
So my childhood experiences in Germany were actually a little bit fearful, which some people may not understand coming from a democratic country. But I came from a country that had finished a war. Everything right. was destroyed. My parents had scars of war victims, so to speak.
Right.
And so even later in the 60s, early 60s, the Soviet Union built a wall segregating 1/4 of Germany from the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. And that border had wired fences and a minefield. And we went there when I was a little child, and I saw the towers with the guards and the machine guns, and it was very frightening to me. Mm-hmm. And so I think because of that internal fear, which I think is very human and very global, I also felt that I could relate to a young Latina woman growing up in a barrio in poverty. I wasn't rich when we grew up. My parents never had a car. We got a TV when I was 11 years old, you know, so.
Yeah, not like today, though.
Yeah, it's not like today. And so I felt that having seen the favelas in Brazil, which is very much like the barrios in Mexico or another country, I felt that I could put myself emotionally and mentally mm-hmm. into that place.
And the fear, sort right. of the universal feeling. Have you spent time in Honduras?
I have actually not been to Honduras. My background in my book is based on research I've done, mm-hmm. but I have been to Brazil, and I also went to the interior of Brazil at the border of Argentina and Paraguay, so mm-hmm. I have seen some of the third mm-hmm. world cities in those places.
Okay, without giving any spoilers, tell us briefly about your protagonist and how she ends up escaping across the border.
So my protagonist's name is Maria Elena Garcia, and I picked that name because Garcia is the most common Spanish Hispanic last name. And so she grows up in a barrio. Her parents don't really support her desire to get a good education and to become sophisticated. As a girl, they feel that she should take care of the siblings, take care of the family. So according to my research, in Honduras, most children need to be in school until they're 15. But at 15, you can leave school and you're done. But in order to get to college and a real good, sophisticated education, you have to do 3 more years of high school. And those 3 years lead to a graduation that's called bachillerato, which is like our bachelor's degree,
right,
but it's actually a high school degree.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what my protagonist wants. And so she fights with her mother. She gets thrown out of the house. She lives on the streets. And luckily she has a great friend who's helping her find jobs, and these jobs afford her to go to school and get that desired degree. And while she's living on the streets, she has a benefactor who helps her protect her, so to speak, living on the streets and living in the city park. And through her friend, who I called Lolita, she actually meets this human trafficker who has a restaurant where Maria Elena ends up working, and her friend works next door, which is a brothel.
Oh, boy.
Yes.
Okay.
And so together they plan to go to the U.S. They save their money, and through this human trafficker.
Yeah, don't tell us anymore. You'll give away the story.
They get to the U.S.
Right. Oh. And I know that that's a universal subject. The human trafficking is of terrible concern, especially here in San Diego. And I also know that the dream for the better life is universal. As you were writing it, was any part of the topic painful?
I didn't find it painful. I think it was more therapeutic.
Mm-hmm.
I read a lot of news about Germany, the Syrian immigrants going to Germany, the African immigrants going to France. And as you said, it is absolutely a dream for a better life. I have friends from Asia who came here for a better life. And so I think that's everybody's dream. You know, everybody wants to live in happiness, in peace, and hopefully not in poverty.
Right.
And so we all strive for that. So I think I agree. It's a very global topic.
So in researching your book, what have you learned about, if anything, about the human trafficking problem here in San Diego?
I actually kind of wrote all that by whatever was inside of me. I did not specifically research that topic for my book. But once it came out and I realized that even though to me it was a subtopic, some people felt that that was a main topic of the book. I have actually joined a human trafficking walk in Vista in January. I found out that January is the Human Trafficking Awareness Month in the U.S., which I never knew. And I have heard a lot of news lately about human trafficking and how prevalent it is. I read news that even in Germany, which is, you know, a free democratic country where women are respected, every sixth woman has been assaulted, which was just mind-boggling to me. And I know here in San Diego, in Vista, there are certain pockets where it's really prevalent. So I'm actually learning more about it now than I did when I wrote the book.
You've discovered a passion.
Yes. And I think to me, the main reason for the book, the main topic was the dream for the better life, the path. How do I get there?
And what made you choose 15 for the age of your protagonist? I know this affects young girls.
Right, absolutely. I think the dreams start when you're a teenager and you start forming your dreams for what do I want to do when I'm an adult? People keep asking you, what do you want to be? And so I felt that not only was that a good age group to approach with this topic, there's also an educational element because young kids are so trusting.
Mm-hmm.
And they may trust somebody who compliments them and gives them jewelry or whatever, and they may not realize that it can lead down a path that they don't want to go.
Or someone who volunteers to assist you across the border.
Exactly.
But there's a price tag on there that you don't understand.
Correct, yes.
Well, I know that you're also an avid traveler. You've traveled extensively through Europe, the U.S., South America. What are the important lessons from traveling that you want to bring to your stories or that you bring to them now and in the future?
I love to travel. I was very fortunate to grow up in Germany, which is surrounded by 9 different countries that speak different languages, and every country has its own culture. So I was spoiled from when I was 3 years old. My grandmother was in Holland, so we went to Holland, we went to Austria, we went to Italy, everywhere. It was fantastic. And then when I got older, I got to visit my family members in Brazil because my great-grandmother had 12 children and took 8 of them to Brazil. So I have a very large family in Brazil. It's actually larger than my German family.
Oh, that's fun.
Yes. And it was great. Some of them I could speak English to, some of them only Spanish and Portuguese. So that was very interesting. But what I've learned is that when you get to know people from a different culture, you open your heart, you become more flexible, you learn compassion and especially gratitude. When you see those favelas or barrios where people live and they have to dig through garbage to find food, it just, you know, how can you not feel compassionate?
Right. Any regrets at all?
Regrets for coming here?
Yeah.
Regrets for writing the story?
No, for immigrants. I don't know, the whole immigration experience.
Oh, I have absolutely no regrets. Right. I love it here.
Okay, one last question. I understand that you're writing a sequel to Five Wishes. Give us a hint of what to look forward to, and might this become a series?
My sequel actually will be called Seaside Daisies, and Maria Elena is still the protagonist. It is her path into her future, where she experiences the United States. She gets to know new people that may or may not help her. She still hangs on to her internal fears and anxiety, which I think a lot of immigrants do. So that's part of my own history. And she needs to learn to overcome that and become courageous internally. So that is the path that she's going to go down. And I think my readers will be very happy with the ending.
Do you think it's going to become another book, or it will stop there?
I actually don't know. I somewhat write by inspiration. Uh-huh. Whatever comes to me. I never planned on a human trafficking story. It just developed.
Right.
And so when I finished the first book, I didn't think there was going to be a sequel. And 2 weeks later, I began writing it. So I really can't foresee it. I just have to open my heart and mind and be receptive to what comes.
To the creative process.
Exactly.
So if you had to give a word of advice to immigrants arriving in San Diego today, what might that advice be?
I would say, don't ever give up.
Okay. Well, that's a good place to end our interview. Our time is up, but thank you, Molly Moon, for joining us.
Thank you, Reina. It was a pleasure.
If you would like more information about Molly Moon and her work, please visit her website at mollymoon.com, and that's M-O-L-L-I-E moon.com. Again, this is Reina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show. If you would like to be the media, here's your opportunity. We're looking for some more talented volunteers for our East County Magazine radio show. So if you've got radio experience or just a great voice, or if you'd like to get experience writing scripts or special reports for the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 619-698-7617 or send an email to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We're your community media, bringing you news from our region that reflects the public interest, not special interests. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producers, John Sepulveda and Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.